This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Gas prices, here we are again. And the latest news is they're going down. But are you seeing that at the pump? And why is it that what you pay is so utterly dependent upon where you pay? From APM, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 15th day of March. And rest assured, I plunged no knives into Caesar or Kai today. He's just taking the day off. And just as in Roman times, politics remains blood sport. Today, President Barack Obama accused Republicans of riding the political wave, blaming him for high gas prices. But whether the blame is deserved, there is no getting around the political undertow of $4 gas. And that's an average number, because as we know, there is a huge disparity in prices across the country. Marketplace's Scott Tong of our sustainability desk is on the case. Question number one for him, why the heck am I paying $4.85 a gallon on Arroyo Boulevard in Pasadena?
And why am I paying $4.01, Tess, on Robert E. Lee Highway outside Washington? The real question, though, is how come Mark Rout in Houston paid a quarter less than that the other day? He's a consultant at KBC Advanced Technologies.
It was something like $3.76. Houston has relatively low gasoline prices because we have a lot of refining capacity where we produce the gasoline.
So part of the issue is location. They're close to where the gas gets made, which is an issue out east. Three key refineries here are shut down, and almost shut down. Jamie Webster at PFC Energy says refiners know that long-term, the U.S. market is shrinking. We drive less on more efficient cars.
Vehicle miles that Americans drive has actually been going down. There isn't any expectation that that is suddenly going to start rising again.
Without locally made gas, Easterners could get more from the Gulf. Wrong, because the pipelines are full. And as for tankers, Mark Rout says a law called the Jones Act requires ships to be U.S. flagged if they sail from one American port to another.
There just aren't that many of these kinds of ships around. It's virtually impossible to be moving gasoline from Gulf Coast Houston to New York City.
So East Coast prices, Tess, could start to approach, well, yours on the left coast. And you all can thank local gas taxes and regulations, says Phil Flynn at PFG Best.
When you think green, you think California. They're a leader, whether it comes to refineries, whether it comes to drilling, when it comes to smog. California's been a leader, and they pay for it. They do pay through the nose for it.
So this summer test road trip, you and I will meet up with my brother in Colorado Springs, $3.49 a gallon. Jerk. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Yeah, but we've got sun, what, 10 months out of the year? Today, lawmakers in New York voted to cut retirement benefits for future public employees. The measure did not cut as deeply as Governor Andrew Cuomo wanted, but the deal could signal more trouble for public employee unions across the nation. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Pension benefits for future public workers have now been cut in 44 states. But Ron Snell at the National Conference of State Legislatures says it's especially significant in New York.
I think there are messages there for the whole country.
Namely, state and local lawmakers are determined to cut public pensions no matter how politically risky it might be.
I think it's significant this is happening in a state with a powerful organized labor movement and that the legislature takes actions that it knows aren't going to be real popular because they see this as necessary for the long-term fiscal well-being of the state of New York.
Tom Jurevich is a labor studies professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He says the cuts show not just how dire things are for the states, but how weak this has left the unions.
When this happens in New York State, it indicates how far this has gone. I think always in this environment now, public sector workers, their salary and their pensions are going to be on the block.
The New York unions had fought the cuts for more than a year, with ads suggesting the Wall Street banks that caused the financial collapse should pay higher taxes to make up the budget shortfall. The intense union pushback might have succeeded in reducing the cuts, but Jurevich says the New York setback demonstrates the tough fight that's still ahead.
This is going to be the real challenge for the labor movement going forward. Approximately one half of American unionized workers are in the public sector.
Jurevich says although 44 states have now made cuts, he expects that's only the first round, with much deeper and painful cuts to come. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
More young adults are living at home than at any time since the 1950s, and you know what? They don't feel bad about it. A study by the Pew Research Center says we are rolling out the welcome mat for the boomerang generation. Marketplace's Sabri Benashour reports.
In his rush to get to work in Vienna, Virginia, Kevin Jacobs has forgotten something.
Is this yours?
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
His roommate hands him his phone.
My roommate is my mother.
Kevin's 23 and has a job, but he still lives at home.
It just seemed like financially the best decision. You know, when I look at how much it would cost to live, you know, on my own, I just wouldn't be able to save any money.
Mom is happy to have him, and he does pay a little bit of rent.
Just to sort of cover some of the shared groceries and, you know, housing and utilities and all that.
So you're not like a total freeloader.
Yes, exactly.
Kevin is part of what Kim Parker calls the boomerang generation. Parker is associate director of the Pew Social and Demographic Trends Project. She says 40% of young adults 18 to 24 live at home.
It really rose dramatically during the years of the recession.
It's a tough world out there for young people. In fact, young people who don't live at home are more likely to live in poverty.
So it may not just be a convenient setup. For some young adults, it may actually be an economic lifeline.
But it's not just the recession. This is something much bigger.
It's really a long U-turn, if you will.
Catherine Newman is Dean of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. She's written about this. Multi-generational living has been on the rise since 1980. More people are going to college, and it takes longer to reach the standard of living kids grew up with. And besides, living with mom and dad isn't as bad as it used to be.
You go to a Rolling Stones concert and you see two kinds of people there, the gray-haired and young people.
I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
Today, the S&P 500 closed above 1,400 for the first time since the financial crisis. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Think of the presidential campaign as a long-distance race. To cross the finish line, you have to have experience, true grit, and a really good strategy. Oh, and of course, lots of money. Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum is facing the Illinois primary next week, and while he may have plenty of grit, the strategy part may be an issue. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has our story.
Say you're Rick Santorum. You're badly outspent by Mitt Romney. You live election to election. You don't have the staff to plan ahead. In politics, that's deadly.
The advantage the Romney campaign has is they can look and play two and three states ahead.
Republican strategist Alex Vogel.
If you're Santorum, you're in much more of a hand-to-mouth. You have to dedicate your resources to the next state.
So now Santorum is focused on Tuesday's primary in Illinois, where it'll be hard for him to compete for some delegates because he didn't have the money for ground troops to file the necessary paperwork in some congressional districts. Those campaign staffers also coordinate volunteers and help get supporters to the polls on Election Day. Mike Duhaime was Rudy Giuliani's presidential campaign manager.
If the other side has a ground organization and you don't, you'll probably be at a disadvantage of 2 or 3 points on election day.
And you're at an even bigger disadvantage if you don't have money for campaign ads. This is a big problem for Santorum, says Davidson College political scientist Josh Putnam.
And it looks like Romney's outspending him on advertising alone about 8-1.
Santorum is trying to turn Romney's negative ads against him with ads of his own, like this.
Mitt Romney's negative attack machine is back.
Santorum wants to make his lack of campaign cash a virtue, touting his underdog status, but he'll still need money to get that message out. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This week, as part of our election coverage, The Real Economy, we're hearing from people across the country about the issues that matter most to them. Today, San Diego resident Nancy Parker argues illegal immigration hurts the economy more than helps it.
It's time we did something about illegal immigration in the United States. I hear talk about economic benefits of illegal immigration, cheap labor and all, but it also has economic costs nobody seems to mention. Many who work here illegally don't keep the money they earn in this country. Instead, they send it off to their relatives in their home countries. It's a drain of resources that doesn't do anything for economic growth here. A lot of the work that they do is off the books, so many aren't even paying taxes. Yet, they're still using free health care, food stamps, and other services meant for low-income and senior citizens. I am not anti-immigrant. I understand why people would risk their lives to come to this country. But we need to have compassion for our own people who are being denied services that are going to illegals. And it's not just services, it's jobs also. I'm always hearing that illegal immigrants are doing work nobody else wants to do. Try telling that to someone who's been out of work for 3 years. I know a lot of Americans who'd be just fine working in the construction industry. Lately, we're hearing a good deal about the income gap. Well, maybe one of the reasons poor Americans aren't making as much is because illegals in this country are willing to work for even less. And what about the direct cost of illegal immigration? The law enforcement, detention, and deportation has to add up to something. Just think of where else we could be using that money. At the end of the day, illegal immigration is just plain wrong. Make all the excuses you want. They've broken the law. If we went to their countries without immigrating through proper channels, we'd be tossed out on our ear immediately.
Nancy Parker is a retiree living in San Diego. Let us know what issues are most important to you this election year. Head to marketplace.org and click on contact. Saturday is St. Patrick's Day, traditionally a day of fun and levity, lots of levity. But many on the Emerald Isle itself are in no mood to celebrate. Ireland is deep in debt. A year ago, the European Union and the International Monetary Fund agreed on a bailout plan. In return, Ireland had to impose severe austerity measures, including tax hikes and spending cuts. And as Christopher Worth reports from Dublin, they are paying the price.
Ask almost anyone in Ireland about how the austerity program is affecting the country's economy, and they're likely to use some rather gruesome metaphors.
If a guy's lying there half dead, you can't come up with a stick and start beating him till he gets better. It's not going to work.
John Corcoran owns this small shoe store on one of Dublin's busiest shopping streets. He says many shops like his are either well behind on rent or have closed altogether.
Well, austerity means our customers, first of all, have less money to spend. You know, the local economy is in a tailspin.
Ireland may be beaten up and bruised, but unlike some troubled Eurozone countries, it hasn't just promised to cut its budget deficit. It's actually doing that with a tough program of lower spending and higher taxes. Alan Barrett is an economist at Trinity College Dublin.
When international lenders will simply not lend you any money, you don't have a choice.
Barrett says there hasn't been much protest because the Irish people felt like the measures were helping the country get out of its present mess. But the latest figures show Ireland's economy is barely growing, if at all. And unemployment is now at 14.5%, the highest level in 20 years.
If people are enduring all this but aren't seeing any positive results, you could end up with this, let me call it austerity fatigue, whereby people stop accepting this. And that's a huge concern.
Austerity fatigue can certainly be felt at this rally against the measures in Dublin.
I'm just barely holding out at the moment, you know.
Joe Flood says he's struggled to find work over the last few years, and he refuses to pay the latest round of new taxes.
we were told maybe a couple of years ago that, you know, take our medicine and it'll be okay. I mean, people, you know, they live in hope that things are going to change around, but just keep piling on the medicine, piling on the medicine. We don't seem to be getting that in return.
And speaking of return, let's go back to those gruesome metaphors so popular in Ireland right now. Economist David McWilliams says the best way to think about Ireland's predicament is to picture a man with his hands around his own throat.
The man is being strangled, but he's been strangled by himself. So the minute you take your hands away from your neck, you begin to recover. You breathe again.
He says if Ireland wants to stop choking off its own recovery, it needs to work out a deal similar to the one Greece has negotiated to lower the amount of debt it owes. After all, he says, Ireland's overall debt, made up mostly of loans to now defunct Irish banks, is far larger than what Greece is on the hook for.
We're never paying that back. And do you know why? Because it's impossible to pay it back. But politically, the European Union needs a success, and we happen to be that model.
McWilliams says the thinking among EU leaders is that if austerity isn't seen to work in Ireland, it can't work in the rest of Europe. And that could mean more budget cuts and tax increases for years to come, no matter how fatigued the country gets. In Dublin, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Coming up, actor Wendell Pierce opens a chain of supermarkets in his native New Orleans.
People always tell me, well, why are you doing grocery stores? I said, because they're needed.
But first, let's do the numbers. Signs the economy continues to pick up steam help lift stocks today. The Dow added 58 points, 0.4% to close at 13,252. The NASDAQ rose 15 points, 0.5% to finish at 3056. And the S&P 500 picked up 8 points, 0.6% to end at 1402. As we mentioned up top, it was the first time the S&P closed above 1400 in 4 years. Bank stocks did especially well today. Shares of Morgan Stanley reeled in 4.9%. Bank of America jumped 4.5%. Citigroup rose 3%. Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs both deposited more than 2%. And after hitting $600 a share in early trading, shares of Apple fell 0.2% to close at a mere 5.85. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.28%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases a consumer price index for February. Also for that month, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production. And someone who thinks really well down and across will walk away with a $5,000 grand prize. The 35th Annual American Crossword Puzzle Tournament gets underway in Brooklyn, New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. High-end designers have partnered with mass market stores for years. Target started the trend back in the early 2000s with Isaac Mizrahi. Fast forward to last fall and the craze over affordable collections from Missoni and more recently Jason Wu. Nanette Lepore is partnering with JCPenney, and you can find Jimmy Choo and Versace at H&M. Well, now Gap Kids and Baby Gap are jumping on the trend with a collection by Diane von Furstenberg at 240 stores around the country. Mata Zepeda takes a look at the retail battle for the youngest fashionistas.
The line launches today, but one store in Los Angeles had it a bit early, and Carla Frieders was there, clutching a heap of tiny clothes.
Tell me what you have in your hands.
Anything, really. I'm looking for any little girl that I know. I don't even have kids, but I always love when these brands do the collaborations with designers, because I feel like you get that designer feel, but it's like at affordable prices for everybody, so I think it's great.
Frieder spent more than $300 on von Furstenberg merchandise, everything from bathing suits and leggings to mini versions of the designer's signature wrap dresses. That, says Art Peck, the president of Gap North America, is one of the main reasons the company is collaborating with Diane von Furstenberg.
Both of us obviously have a commercial interest in this as well. She's in it to make money, and so are we.
The collection is just for little girls, but the idea, says Peck, is that it will also appeal to the real consumers, their moms. Jamie Katz is an equity analyst with Morningstar. She says building a mother-daughter bond to a specific brand is a growing trend.
It builds an interesting kind of brand loyalty when you have kids in the mix that young. If you have 8-year-olds wearing this, children will start becoming familiar with the brand very early on and then will likely stay with it when they have the ability to make their own decisions.
And Gap could use some shopper staying power. The company has been struggling for years through an endless stream of management shakeups, store redesigns, and merchandise makeovers. It's early yet, but here in L.A., the generational approach seems to be working. Deborah Brahe is shopping with her daughter and 2 granddaughters.
You know, generationally, I think it's fun that I was able to say to them, oh, I used to have a Diane Van Tottenham dress, so that was fun for me. And for them, too.
And Brahe has something else in common with her 6-year-old granddaughter, Lily.
I think when I bought my wrap dress in the 60s, I think it was about $89, which was a lot of money.
The price tag on that white eyelet DVF wrap dress Lily picked out? $75. In Los Angeles, I'm Mara Zapeta for Marketplace.
We loved him as Detective William Bunk Moreland on The Wire. A man has got to have a code. You may also know him as the trombone-playing Antoine Batiste from HBO's Tremé. But actor Wendell Pierce is adding a new role to his list of credits, one you probably won't find on IMDb. In December, he opened Sterling Express, the first in a chain of grocery stores selling fresh produce and other staples in his hometown of New Orleans. Many of the city's lower-income neighborhoods, places like the Lower Ninth Ward, had a dearth of stores to begin with, a situation made worse by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Wendell Pierce is here to talk about why he is stepping into the void. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tess.
Now, I was in New Orleans last fall, so 6 years post-Katrina, and this is something that can't help but strike you driving around parts of downtown, certainly the lower-income neighborhoods, the utter lack of both grocery stores and gas stations. How far do some folks have to go to get fresh food?
You know, you look at the Lower Ninth Ward, it was an issue even before the storm because it's the paradigm of American urban centers where, you know, American industry and commerce sits on the sideline. They see it as a that it's someplace that's of no interest to them at times, really. And we haven't had a decent grocery store in the Lower Ninth Ward in 20 years.
I first came upon this issue visiting about 3 years after Katrina. And the problem at the time, I think, was that stores didn't want to come back to New Orleans until people came back. And then a lot of people weren't going to come back to neighborhoods without infrastructure, including stores. Is that still part of the issue?
There's that catch-22. But now people have demonstrated that they're going to come back to New Orleans, that they have a loyalty to their neighborhood, to loyalty to the city. And the thing that's disappointing is the fact that you have American industry sitting on the sidelines. And it's that sort of, that is the atmosphere that we're in. And you realize that the recovery has to be comprehensive.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that made me realize that we have food deserts and we have to meet those needs as well.
What does it mean in a community when you don't have affordable places to shop for food?
First of all, it means that people are going to buy what they can get their hands on. And it's going to be processed, fast, quick, unhealthy choices. The thing that's kind of a paradox and kind of ironic is the fact that actually the very cuisine that New Orleans is known for, the men and women from those communities created it, you know, going back hundreds of years. You know, working class folks in New Orleans came up with gumbos and jambalayas, and we were more agrarian then. And it was those working people that did it. And now that we're in this urban setting and they don't have access to those fresh products, it just means the children are going to be unhealthy. We have a pandemic of diseases from obesity. it actually has less to do with this wonderfully rich food that we have and has more to do with lesser access to fresh foods.
How did you decide what affordable means? Because that's part of this too, not just fresh, but also affordable. How might your stores be different?
It's a matter of markup. It's a matter of saying that let's take advantage of pooling resources. We'll be a part of the Associated Grocers membership, which, you know, the more membership that you have, it grows this wholesale business that allows you to buy in larger quantities of products for a cheaper price, and then you can carry that over the savings to people. You know, people are paying $6-7 for a gallon of milk.
Why go into the grocery business on your part? Why not try to use your celebrity bully pulpit, what have you, to maybe convince the likes of Winn-Dixie to come back? Why start fresh for you?
Because Winn-Dixie left. And now I can spend most of my time trying to convince others to do it or do it or step into that void myself. If not me, who? If not now, when? If not here, where?
Wendell Pierce, thank you.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if nothing in this world is certain but death and taxes, then the mayor of a town north of Naples, Italy, had better ban taxes because he has already banned death. Giulio Cesare Fava resides over a hamlet of 4,000 citizens and told them about a week and a half ago that it is, quote, forbidden for residents to go beyond the boundaries of earthly life and to go into the afterlife because the cemetery is running out of room. An expansion had been planned, but to again quote the mayor, there are no more riches available. So far, two residents have defied the order to no real legal consequence. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 58 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ rose 15, 0.5%. And the S&P 500 was up 8 points, 0.6%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.